You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Senate is voting on a bill today that will be the first in what's expected to be dozens of amendments to the Better Care Reconciliation Act. It's meant to take the place of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. However, Americans are concerned about losing their health care entirely. In Iowa, we have one insurer that's still offering individual policies through a health network. On Saturday morning, citizens in Sioux City and four other areas will meet to talk about the current situation of health care and health insurance. Our Lives on the Line is being held from 10:30 to noon in the Sioux City Community Theater. Longtime teacher and activist Jean Carlson is one of the organizers of that event.
What it is, it's a positive conversation, a community dialogue on health care, where people go, tell their stories, and hear stories on health care, and we have some people from the community from different departments and different organizations coming to tell about how the health care laws would affect people that go to their organizations or their businesses.
Why did you want to do this?
Well, I have a passion for helping people, and I really do believe everybody should have health care. They should have affordable health care. They should have health care with the word care in it so that people don't have to worry about their health. And I want to make sure everybody gets health care. And so I'm just fighting for that, to make sure everybody has affordable health care.
It seems like when you look at the possibilities for the next year, having one big carrier who would, take on new people for health insurance in Iowa, and they might pull out as well. A lot of people are probably very worried about that.
They are. We're lucky that we have Medica. It's the only Obamacare agency that's still here, so we're lucky that they still have Medica. And I personally know a family member on Medica, and that person's been very happy and satisfied with Medica. So I'm just relieved. I know there are other states or a few that may not have that situation, and they have to be very worried and scared.
So what do people do if they're bumped off their plan? And, Medica, what if Medica can't take care of everybody? I bet these are big concerns.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to have Congress come to an agreement and have some bipartisan committees and some public hearings with the CBO scores and just take their time and do it right. Make Obamacare better so that everyone can have affordable health care and not have the stress and worry for their lives.
Yeah, I imagine you've heard a lot of stories that have stress and worry in them.
I've heard so many stories, and that's why we wanted to have this community event over at the Sioux City Community Theater from 10:30 till noon this Saturday, where people can come and share their stories if they want to. And that we can help understand what they're going through. And then if they don't have a story, at least we can, we'll be the ones to listen. And then hopefully we can kind of come to some agreements like, well, what can we suggest for our congresspeople to do?
I think that's one of the hardest parts of all this is we have people in Congress. There seems to be a lot of debate about what's right and what's wrong. And now the whole thing has stalled. And it looks like it's that. And that bill itself is just going to die, and they're going to have to come up with something else.
As I drove over here today, I heard President Trump on the radio saying that they're going to vote again tomorrow. So we'll see what happens there. They do keep the words repeal and replace, but no matter what happens, we need to have it replaced and made better. Or don't replace it, make it better.
And those are really the biggest issues here is that, we've sort of created this system, call it Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act,
right,
however you want to name it, and it's set up a system. So how do we replace that in a way that keeps in place the things that people really want? And it seems like some of these plans that are being discussed don't do that.
Yes, after the health care bill got passed at the House, they had a celebration in the Rose Garden, and then later President Trump said it was a cruel bill because it didn't have the heart in it. And so then the Senate has been going way too fast, and, you know, they're writing it with only 13 people behind closed doors, and then it comes out, and they want to vote on it immediately. And, you know, they need to slow it down. I say the turtle wins the race, and let's do it right and do it bipartisan. And now, if they take away the ACA or Obamacare and start from scratch, well, not really scratch, but they take the plans and make them better, just have it be with, like I said, public hearings, debates, bipartisan effort, because then everybody can speak up for the poor, the middle class, the sick, the older people. This last bill that was in the Senate that did not pass, if you were between 50 and 64 years old, you could pay 115% more on your monthly premiums, which, for instance, would affect my husband. And right now, he has Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is extremely high. I won't say the number here on the radio, but it would be 113%, you know, more. So that's doubled plus. And, you know, middle-class people really can't afford increases like that. The elderly, 50 to 64, can't really, most people can't afford that kind of an increase.
And you really have sort of two different levels of quote-unquote, you know, seniors. You have people from 50 to 64 who have totally different issues from people, you know, 65 and on.
That's right. That's right. And 65 and on, they'll go on and get their Social Security and Medicare. So they're probably covered with Medicare and for their supplement. You need a supplement to go with that. And the supplement is low cost compared to the premiums that they've been paying up until age 65. But speaking of Medicare, July 29th, this Saturday, is the 50th birthday of Medicare. And that's why all across the United States, every state is doing something for health care in different cities across the United States. It could be anywhere. Most of them are not protests. They are mostly dialogues, conversations, you know, just issuing in or specializing and zeroing in on what are the exact problems, what can we do, what are the stories of the people. In Iowa, there are six cities having this health care event, and each city has a committee, planning committee, doing their own event. Even though the original founder basically across America is the Iowa Women's March, but it's also sponsored by our Indivisible, Planned Parenthood, MoveOn.org, OFA, ADA, CCI, and a total of 70 different sponsors in these six different cities. So like Sioux City, Des Moines, Waterloo, Dubuque, Davenport, Cedar Rapids. It's kind of exciting because it's the grassroots movement. We're all getting together and planning, and ours is peaceful, and it's going to be kind of a, I don't want to say, it is a family event, but we're going to have coffee, we're going to have music, I want to say relaxing. People just come out and spend some time together.
So it's not a situation where if someone comes up and has a question, they have to be worried about feeling stupid that they don't know something.
No, and we may not have the answers because a lot of us are non-medical people, you know, and non-insurance people, but we can, maybe somebody can relate to the question and could help them out, or somebody from these agencies could help answer the question.
So you think a lot of the answer to some of this problem might come from the grassroots, might come from people getting together and talking about it, and then talking to their congressperson, talking to someone at the state house.
Right. That could help a lot. You know, if we can have they'll probably have to call the Congress people, because it's really hard to get a town hall where you can go in and speak to the Congress people. They probably have to call or send faxes or emails, because that seems to be the way that that it's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. It seems like healthcare has changed so much since Medicare came into being. And mm-hmm. there are so many medications for so many illnesses, and people live so much longer, and it's a wonderful thing. But on the other hand, all of this is so expensive, apparently, and difficult to keep going. And mm-hmm. so it's very hard for me when I think about that, like, how do you find an answer to this kind of conundrum?
Yeah, that's why we need the bipartisan Congress people listening to the public, and then that's what they're paid for, you know, to help put this all together and to make the best health care laws in the United States that are possible. I think they can come out with a fantastic law if they take what they've got now and they with the Obamacare and then put in what the committees working together will come up with. You know, they'll keep in pre-existing conditions, hopefully. They'll keep in helping the disabled. You know, they'll keep in helping special needs students. They'll keep in helping the elderly in the nursing homes, that kind of thing. I do think many people aren't even aware of what they can lose if we don't get the best of the law with the bipartisan effort.
So people can just come out this Saturday? They don't have to register for this?
No, they don't have to register. There is an Iowa March site on Facebook. If anybody wants to register, they can, and then they can pick Sioux City. And then it's the way that they do it. They click on ticket, but it's free. And then they're automatically registered. But they do not have to register. They can just come out, walk in, and come out and have coffee and coffee cake with us and an enjoyable morning.
That was Jean Carlson, one of the organizers of Our Lives on the Line, a community conversation about healthcare and health insurance this Saturday morning at 10:30 at the Sioux City Community Theater. Similar meetings are being held at the same time in Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Dubuque, and Des Moines. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Local Democrats are also meeting up this week to talk about grassroots efforts to improve the lives of Iowans. Jeremy Dumkriger is the leader of Woodbury County Democratic Party. He says that tonight at the Sioux City Public Library, the party is holding a discussion on community organizing and grassroots efforts, and everyone is welcome.
The event is called Rise Up, Organize. We're getting together with the Teamsters and their Team Can. It's their Team of Community Action Network. And what we're doing is basically asking people to come in to learn a little bit more about organizing and go door to door, door knock with their neighbors and their friends and their family. Just start talking to people and start getting out there and finding out what their issues are and making sure that everyone's on board for that next election.
And so you're teaming up with some union people on this, right?
The Teamster, correct, yeah.
So what is it about their abilities that you want to tap into?
Well, I attended one of their seminars a couple months ago, and they just shot straight from the hip. You know, they just told it like it was, and I really appreciated that, and I wanted them to come down and have other people hear it from somewhere other than me that what needs to be done. It's like we have to kind of get off Facebook a little bit, got to kind of get off Twitter, stop watching so much MSNBC, and just get out there and start knocking on doors and talking to folks.
So it's kind of a more proactive stance you guys are taking.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're going to work on some organizing people, some grassroots kind of work, right?
Right.
So what would that entail? You're going to have this event Wednesday night?
Wednesday night. 6 o'clock at the library, yep.
6 o'clock at the library, and you're going to talk about ways that you can get people energized?
Exactly. We're going to talk about how to talk to people who aren't necessarily involved with the party as much as they should be or could be. We're going to talk about youth. We're going to talk about what we can do in the community to help people do different things. Like, for example, if there's a problem with a street, you know, we can talk to those people and guide them sort of who they need to talk to. Do you need to talk to, you know, the city council? You need to talk to the mayor. Well, that's probably an issue for the state legislators. You know, we want to point that out to them and help them in any way we can.
Do you find that people do have things they want to fix, they want to improve, but they just don't know how to go about it?
I think so. I think that's the big problem we deal with now. I think they're also just frustrated with everything. They look around and they just don't know if they can change anything themselves. But that's just completely not true. If we all band together, we can change anything.
I know there's been a lot of protesting since President Donald Trump was elected. Those seem to be very anti kinds of efforts. These sound more like pro efforts, pro other types of organizing and causes instead of just anti.
Right. Right. So what we've decided to do is, for example, last Wednesday at the River Cape Parade, we didn't have anything negative. It's everything that we want to see happen. We want to see change. We want to see the wages raised. We want to see healthcare for everybody. We want to see, clean water, these types of things, better jobs for our community, higher paying jobs. And what we want to do is get out there and spread that message. We don't want to really be anti-Trump anymore. We want to be pro-Democrat, pro-progressive ideas. How do you do that? Is, well, we go talk to our neighbors and we're going to organize. Protesting is fun. I've been there. I've been around a lot of protests in my life. But there comes a time when it's like, well, I got to stop standing in front of an empty building that's locked and closed on Saturday. And we got to go knock on doors in that time. That's where our effort needs to go.
Who is the most famous community organizer?
The most famous? Probably Barack Obama.
Right.
Harry Truman said there's no more important job than a precinct organizer.
That was Jeremy Dumkrieger, the leader of the Woodbury County Democratic Party. He's hosting a discussion tonight at the Sioux City Public Library called Rise Up, Organize. It begins at 6 p.m. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Lake Okoboji and all the Iowa Great Lakes are also referred to as the Prairie Lakes. They're beautiful lakes, but they have special challenges when it comes to water quality, vegetation, and shoreline retention. Next week, or rather the week after that, environmental experts and lay people will meet in Okoboji for the Prairie Lakes Conference to talk about those issues and more. John Wills is helping to put that conference together. Wills says the Prairie Lakes stem from the Prairie Pothole region, and it was basically glacial terrain in the very beginning.
Yeah, so the lakes in the Prairie Pothole region, or these Prairie Lakes that we talk about, are generally, 5 feet to 10 feet, 15 feet deep. They're not very deep. They're very shallow. They're broad, which means the wind kind of hits them in weird ways and causes the bottom sediment to stir. And so you look at Spirit Lake is a good example that a lot of people know. It's a very wide, very shallow lake. It's only 17 feet on the average. And so when you look at that lake and compare it to some of the other lakes around the United States, it's a very different kind of lake, and very specific kind of conference is needed to address that. Now, one thing that we also want to point out, just because it's called the Prairie Lakes Conference doesn't mean that we just cover lakes. Eventually, someday, we might cover streams that are located here in these Prairie Lakes.
So what are some of these topics? I see the issue of invasive species is on this list.
So we have three different tracks. We have a professional track, so professional water quality managers, professional people that deal with water quality on a daily basis for their job. And then we have a layperson track, which is just the average person on the street can come and learn a lot about different things, in which the invasive species is part of that track. And then we have another track for the kind of the person that wants to be involved in a watershed, but really wants to learn more about how to get involved and how to do things. And we call that the Watershed Management Authority tract. There's actually a code in the state of Iowa that allows for setting up a Watershed Management Authority. And so those people that attend that track would actually learn a little bit about how that's done, but also maybe how it's done in other states. Those same kind of authorities, or those same kind of creations, could how they're done in other states. So
how important is this watershed management? Because I hear a lot about this in the last 10 years or so.
State of Iowa, the legislature recognizes watershed management as being crucial to being successful. I think all professional watershed managers understand that you've got to deal with water quality on a watershed basis and not just on a county or on a state basis. It has to be dealt with on a watershed basis. And so you can't really manage water quality without understanding that watershed and understand how that watershed can be affected in the best way.
Does this also have to do with sort of trying to channel rainwater runoff and all of that?
Well, it certainly can, because if you don't know where that rainwater is going to go, you can't really be very effective at treating it. So, you know, if we look at a watershed as being kind of the, you know, where a drop of rain lands and travels, if you can understand that, then you can set up conservation practices that can best intercept that drop of water, clean it up, and then release it back into that watershed. So if you want a specific water body that you want to clean, you've got to know where that water can come from in order to intercept it and then release it down to that water body.
What is it about shallow lakes that maybe is a little different from the deeper lakes in terms of trying to maintain the purity of the water and the usability of them?
The churning of the wind definitely affects them more and faster. So any nutrient that is in the bottom of the lake tends to get re-stirred up and then it's available for algae. And algae in the lakes are really what we want to stop, these tremendous heavy blue-green algae blooms, which actually can form a toxin and that poisonous to animals and humans, and that it can cause rashes. I've heard of cases where pets, dogs in particular, have died or gotten very sick because of drinking water that was contaminated with these algae. So the shallow lakes tend to be very good reservoirs for phosphorus, and phosphorus grows this algae very, very readily. So the you know, stirring of the bottom and allowing that phosphorus to be resuspended causes that algae to have nutrient to grow on. But they also tend to tended to have a lot of vegetation in them, and because the mud and the muck is making that sun not be able to reach the bottom of the lake, the vegetation isn't there anymore. And so there really is a whole aspect of specific problems associated with shallow lakes that in a deeper lake where the vegetation really isn't, look at Lake Michigan, for example. There's not a lot of vegetation in Lake Michigan out after you get a couple hundred feet off of the shore, or even maybe 100 feet off of the shore, whereas in most of our lakes there typically was.
What are some of the issues when it comes to protecting the shoreline?
Well, that's a great question, because right now here in the Iowa Great Lakes we have a tremendous push for people to put seawalls, concrete seawalls. And it's an attractive thing for some people to have this very manicured seawall. But what it does is it disconnects the shoreline from the lake and actually causes a lot of environmental problems or conservation type problems. So what we would, rather see is a more natural shoreline that has flowers and grasses and that sort of thing on the shoreline. It's a lot more inexpensive to do that, and provides a better shoreline for the lake. A good example of that is we just did a project on Center Lake, which is one of the lakes here in the Iowa Great Lakes, where we had a shoreline, about 1,200 feet of shoreline, that was very quickly eroding. It was all on DNR, state-owned property, so it was an easy thing to be able to move forward with, but we went in there and removed some of the trees, and we took away all the vegetation, and we basically took away some of the shoreline so that we had a nice slope instead of a cliff from the lake shore down into the lake. And we put some rock and riprap along the lake shore, and now we have a very nice shoreline that is no longer eroding into the lake, that is really doing a great thing. But that's 1,200 feet of shoreline. It was providing 300 tons of sediment or pollutant to the lake each year. So by doing this project on this 1,200 feet, we're able to reduce that to almost nothing. I'm not going to say we've reduced it to nothing just yet, but it's pretty close to nothing.
Do you find when you talk to people about this, sometimes they don't really have any idea of all the issues that are going on and what's going on in the lake and on the shore? Because it's a, you know, up there you go to Okoboji, you go to Spirit Lake. It's a, there are beautiful lakes. It's a beautiful place. Sometimes it's hard to understand that there are issues.
Yeah. I will tell you that's probably the biggest challenge, is because we've got water quality data for the Owl Great Lakes here, where we've been working since 1992 very diligently to try to fix some of the problems at the lake. And our water quality has been steadily improving over those 18 years. The phosphorus level has been declining. The clarity of the water has been increasing. And so over 18 years, people haven't noticed the change, because it's just been a gradual change. And then, when you say we've got to, take care of our lakes and clean up the water problems, they really don't see it because, we've been really improving the water quality and the clarity. And so they kind of just see good, clean water. And that is true. We're getting better all the time. But then, you throw in the vegetation that all of a sudden just out of nowhere appears because the water clarity has cleaned up that much. And so then they're concerned about all of this vegetation, or they call it weeds, seaweed, is all of a sudden growing, and where did this come from, and how come we never had it before? And so there's new problems that are cropping up that we've got to try to treat and understand. And the education of people is so important to know that, here's why you've got this new vegetation growing, or this new seaweed is out in front of your property. It's because the water clarity has all of a sudden gotten so much better. But then you add another problem. We've got invasive species that have all of a sudden cropped up, and we've got to educate people about what those invasive species are going to do and how they're going to affect our lakes and that sort of thing. So education is crucial, that we make sure that people continue to be educated and understand our lakes and the water that we have in them.
That was John Wills. He's the organizer of the Prairie Lakes Conference. That conference is being held Wednesday through Friday, August 9th through 11th, at the Arrowwood Resort and Conference Center in Okoboji. For more information and registration information as well, you can go to plciowa.com. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Getting over the death of a friend or family member can be daunting for an adult, but for children and teenagers, it can be a very difficult process. That's why the Hospice of Siouxland is holding Camp Courage in September. The camp is for youth ages 6 to 17 years old. John Giorgio is a bereavement counselor at the organization. He's preparing for this year's Camp Courage. Giorgio says the camp is a place for kids to unwind and share their feelings with peers who are going through the same journey.
Two main things that I've learned to point out is that it's a safe and fun place for grieving children. And so those two things are both equally important. So it's safe both physically, obviously, but then emotionally. Whatever is happening in your grief, it's okay there. You don't have to apologize or try to hide that. And then the fun part is equally important, because kids by nature want to have fun, and they might be living in a house where there's not much of that going on right now, and they might not be sure how to do that while they're grieving. And so camp is a place where they meet other kids who are also dealing with the death of a loved one, and these wonderful volunteer staff members who are there, and they learn that they can grieve and have fun in the same place with the same people. And then they go back, and on the last day, we bring in their parents or their family, an adult family member, and maybe some siblings, and they do an activity together and learn that, oh, this isn't just for camp. This is something I can do in my family. And then they go home, and hopefully they, as a family, get more comfortable grieving and having fun together again.
What are some of the activities you have that are the more fun activities there?
Oh, just for fun, we have a campfire, we make s'mores, we'll have a kickball game or ultimate frisbee on free time, or some of the kids prefer to do some crafty things on free time, beading, making friendship bracelets and things like that.
In some ways, it's like a regular camp.
Yeah. If you were an observer who came and didn't overhear any conversation, you would just think this is a weekend camp. And I think of it a lot of times as being similar to like a church camp that people are familiar with, where they go and learn more about their faith, which might be the less common thing, but the other side is that they also run around and play and have fun and sing songs and all those things. So it's similar that way. It's just the grief part is the focus in terms of the deep part of it. And you can't tell, even as a counselor, like last year we had this storm hit during camp and literally a cottonwood limb fell right over a group that was having their group meeting, and they dove off of the bleachers and it split the bleachers in half. But the kids were, you know, everyone came out okay, a couple of bumps and bruises. But then, so we had to have all the kids in a storm shelter. And at midnight, all the kids were settled down and laying on these mattresses on the floor. And I was exhausted, but there was two girls politely talking. And I thought they were just chit-chatting. So it's like, okay, girls, you got to quiet down. And, you know, we start the conversation up again tomorrow. Well, they just look at me serious as anything, and the one says, well, we're talking about why she's here and why I'm here. And so I couldn't tell that they were having a serious conversation about their grief. You know, it just looked like two 11-year-old girls chit-chatting, you know. So it just becomes a natural thing, and I think that's the most powerful part about camp, is that the kids learn that it's quite natural to talk about this stuff.
Is that what you mean when you say that at camp you try to normalize grief?
Yeah, exactly. It's because grief can be isolating or alienating, because you walk around, and especially for like middle school age kids or kids who have that awareness that I want to be like everybody else. Well, suddenly I've got this, what seems like a really unique thing on my mind, that my dad died or my mom died or my grandpa who used to take care of me after school has died, or my sibling. And so you feel weird because I don't think anybody else is thinking about this right now. Well, suddenly you're in a place where, yeah, like these kids look normal to me, and they're happy, healthy kids like me, but they're also dealing with this. So I must not be so strange after all. So then once you don't feel so strange about your grief, then it's like, oh, okay, I can talk about it or not talk about it. That's my choice. But it's less of a less of that elephant in the room sort of feeling for them.
What kind of feedback do you get after the camp is over from the families?
You know, we hear things like how powerful the ride home in the car is, because the kids are just talking about, oh, we made this memory box, and I put this glitter and that on, and the picture of dad right in the middle, you know, and the mom's like, trying to not cry so much that she, you know, she's trying to be able to keep driving because the kid has never talked about this yet. But the kid's talking about it just naturally because it was a thing they did at camp. And so we hear that sort of thing, like, oh my gosh, this is an open topic now. Whereas before I couldn't get anywhere. And then other times you just feel, you know, my son, I feel like I heard someone say, you know, like, I got my son back. Because he had been so tightened up about it that he was irritable and cranky and couldn't sleep good, and no one wanted to be around him either. And now suddenly he's like his relaxed, fun self again, even if he doesn't talk a lot about the death. But he just doesn't have that energy tied up with fear. So
it's coming up in September, so now might be a good time for people, if they want to explore it, to give you a call and see what the details are.
Exactly. We have registrations are open now. We have, you know, reached out to churches and social service agencies and medical clinics in the area, and also people we know that had some interest. But we also are open to phone calls or emails. You can go onto our website at hospicesofsiouxland.com and go to the contact page, and just at 11 o'clock at night when the kids are finally asleep, you can send a message saying, hey, I'd like to check out more about this, and then let us know when's a good time to reach you. I like to encourage people to let their kids know, like, it is actually a fun weekend. It's not like broccoli. It's not something that you should do because it's good for you, but you're not going to like it. It's actually something that will be good for you, but it's quite fun. And to not to wait till their teenager or young kid is, don't wait till they're falling off the cliff. It's prevention rather than a cure. We don't look at kids who are grieving as broken or sick. We look at them as kids who are just going through a tough time and need some support, and this just can give them a boost along the way.
That was John Giorgio, bereavement counselor for Siouxland Hospice. He was talking about Camp Courage for kids who've lost a loved one, and that's set for September. You're listening to Siouxland Public Media, The Exchange. And coming up next, we're going to hear from an author who used to work here in Sioux City. Bill Zarin has been writing novels for a while now, but he was first a reporter for the Sioux City Journal. He's a Lake City native and a graduate of Morningside College. His latest book is called Avenging Angel, a Kingman and Reed novel, the third in a series about an ambitious newspaper reporter and a female district attorney who both work in Sioux City. Zarin says he wasn't so much concerned about success or failure when he started to write books.
I wasn't really concerned with being successful. I mean, that was fine. If I became the next Grisham, I wouldn't have complained, but I just wanted to write a book. My goal when I started Officer Involved way back in, probably 1997, was just to write a book. I just wanted to write a book because that seems to be the ultimate for a writer, a serious hardcore writer, and I just wanted to see if I could do it and write a book and make a book that I was proud of, and just get it printed in some fashion, and that was it. The goal wasn't to make money or get rich or anything like that. It was just to accomplish the task or the challenge of writing a book.
And this is your third book. Are all of the books then about this particular journalist that is a pretty successful writer, and he works at the Sioux City quote-unquote journal? Not really.
Yeah.
It's got a different name.
they're all the same series and the same characters. Tom Kingman, who's he's late 20s, and Hillary Reed is the Woodbury County prosecutor, and they're the duo that are in all three books.
And so how did you come up with the character for the book? Is he partly you? Is he partly other journalists as well?
Yeah, I tell people Tom Kingman's the newspaper reporter I wish I was, or in my dreams. He does a lot of things that probably real reporters wouldn't do, and his attitude is a little bit, it's not me, I'm not as outgoing or hell-bent or anything like that, but so he's a little bit of me, but he's really my idealized newspaper reporter with plenty of flaws. And Hillary Reed is really a combination of a bunch of people. I worked the court beat there in Sioux City for a few years, and I really enjoyed that, and I came across a lot of female attorneys, so she's kind of a compilation of all of them put together.
In your books, seems like there seems to be a murder at the beginning, and a lot of the unfolding plot has to do with figuring out what happened with that. Is it hard for you to come up with these plots? Are they something, do they come out of your, personal experience as a reporter?
The first thing that comes to me is who's going to die and where, because I try to start off with a murder pretty quickly in a book. I don't like murder mysteries that takes half a book to get to the actual murder. I like to get the dirty deed done up front, so to speak. So I'll see stuff in newspaper articles or online or different kinds of other fiction, how people die and why. So usually that's kind of, I know the setting, I know where I want it to be in Sioux City or wherever, and then I figure out how somebody dies. And there's usually two main themes in every book. One is figure out the murder mystery, and the other is the evolving relationship between Tom and Hillary.
Their relationship seems somewhat troubled by the fact they're so busy in their careers.
Right. It's kind of a Hatfield-McCoy. You know, the press's role is watchdog on everything, including the courts, and the court doesn't want the media to know a bunch of stuff that, you know, that's confidential, and the media can screw up their case pretty easy. So I did that on purpose because I wanted it to be sort of an opposite to track, and two characters are very... There's part of me in each character. Like, Tom is kind of the rambunctious, I don't care, tends to be profane, and Hillary is the buttoned up, by the rules, what you should do, you know, high integrity. And so there's an opposites there that I wanted them to have, and they, as the relationship evolves, they get down to more layer, get down deeper, and they discover that they have very much a lot in common, aside from their differences in profession.
In the book, you sort of describe a lot of places that are familiar to Sioux Cityans, the courthouse, the jail area, the city building, and all the drama that unfolds on 4th Street. As a person who lives here, it really resonates with me. Do you think that that must resonate with other people as well, in that sort of that sense of place?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I've read books that were set where I live, or in Okoboji or whatever, and it's fun to have real venues used in a book, and it's fun for me to write, to imagine. I know the setting, you know, and I can see it, so I imagine moving people around in it. That's also fun. I try to, my rule is kind of, if something positive or just happens, it'll be like a real restaurant or a real bar if they just go there and eat. I'll use the real name. But if it's something like negative, like the bar owner's a coke dealer or something, then obviously I make that up and I don't use a real location. So one of the reasons I chose Sioux City is because I like Sioux City a lot, and it really makes my books unique. And I've heard from a lot of people that they get a kick out of the real settings used in a fictional book.
One of the things I appreciate being a journalist is how realistically you describe what goes on in a newsroom between journalists. There's a lot of competition. There are people that are always butting heads. And also the relationship between journalists and, you know, people in law enforcement, in the courts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always had a good experience. I mean, there's always, as you know, from personal experience, there's always going to be some friction. You want to know something that law enforcement or doesn't want you to know, or some, you know, whatever. But during my 7 years as a reporter in Sioux City, I had a very much positive experience working with the police department, the sheriff's department, fire department. They all seemed to tell me what they could tell me and didn't tell me what they couldn't tell me. And it was all very professional, and they were not hostile to the press as far as I saw. But yeah, that's part of the deal with, I think that's what kind of makes a newspaper reporter as a protagonist, which there aren't a lot of books out there that have that, which kind of makes it interesting for him. And unlike a cop, he can do a lot of things that the police aren't going to be able to do, like track people with electronic stuff and go and, you know, sort of almost break into places and have a look. You know, they're not going to be able to do that. So that's kind of the unique part of the reporter as a protagonist.
And your next book, is it set in Okoboji?
Yeah, it's called Tipsy House. It's set in Okoboji. I'm going through the editing right now. My beta readers, friends, are reading it. And that has a whole bunch of locales and, you know, places that are used in the book, and that was a lot of fun. But Tom and Hillary go to Okoboji, and they meet Tom's father, who lives in my hometown, Lake Park. And, of course, somebody dies while they're there, so they have to figure that out.
Do you feel like you've kind of cracked the code as to how to write a successful novel and to go on and write a series of novels about the same characters? Because it seems it's a real art, I think, to make this work.
Yeah, I was a little bit concerned about how that would go. Originally, I just thought Officer Involved, my first book, would just be a one-off, but I really personally love series that have recurring characters. Because I like to see, you get to know the character, and if the author's good enough, he or she can make them consistent and they can grow over time, and it's the follow-up. And then also, the biggest challenge to me was, if, what if somebody just picks up, like, Paper Trail, my second book, will they get it? That's kind of always a challenge. How much backstory to put in without causing spoilers for the first one, or, you know, that sort of thing. And as far as writing them, I've had a lot of people tell me they're very page-turner. They read them in a day or two, and that's extremely gratifying. That's the kind of book I like, that just grabs you and won't let you go. And it has become easier as I've written them. I have three out. Tipsy House is being edited, and I have a fifth one called The Traffic, that's set in around Smithlin in rural Woodbury County. That it does get a little bit easier as far as the structure and the plot goes as the novels come out.
But you say you really love writing. Didn't you say it's for you like playing golf?
Yeah, I did. It's kind of my hobby. I mean, that's kind of how I justify the money I put into this and the time I put into this. When I get done with my day job, my billable, instead of going out to play golf or whatever you do for fun, I start writing fiction. That's just my fun.
So far, I'm enjoying your books and your characters, and it's just always sort of nice to read a book about a journalist. Either the person is ridiculously good or ridiculously bad. I find it refreshing to have a real person in there.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that. One of my concerns that I keep in mind is, you never want to make your characters too perfect, because, like you said, it's unbelievable. So it's easy to make Tom flawed. He's got a lot of flaws, and he understands those. And like I said, he's kind of the flawed side of me. And my main concern is making Hillary too perfect, because she's my favorite character. It's fun to write about her. She's a strong alpha female woman in a job, and Tom loves her for that. But in book three, if you're reading Avenging Angel, I won't give you a spoiler, but at the end you find a big flaw in Hillary, and I have to go out of my way to make her have her some warmth, because I don't want her to be too perfect.
Well, Bill, thanks a lot for talking with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's always great to hear from people back in Sioux City, and I'm just glad that my books are bringing a little attention to that corner of the state. I tell people down here that Des Moines faces east, and the 712, the Western Iowa, is kind of a forgotten part of the state, so I'm glad to give it some pub.
That was author Bill Zarin. His latest book in his series is called Avenging Angel, a Kingman and Reed novel. His next book is set in Okoboji, and it's called Tipsy House. Well, we're just about done with today's program. Next week, we're taking a little break from the exchange, and we are going to hear from Shelby Pierce and Ike Rayford from We Are Not a Monolith. Now, next week, you guys are going to do a whole hour of your show.
Right.
Yeah, right. We sure are.
Looking forward to it. We're a little excited about that.
So what's going to be on the show?
Well, Mary, we've actually done some interviews, even just warming up to doing the show. We'll speak with a friend, Ryan Dowelbaum. We'll touch base with our Checking the Box series.
Right. We're going to recap that series that we've done. And Shelby and I actually went to the movie Girls Trip, and so we may have a review for that movie as well. So.
Now, that looks like an African-American bridesmaid or, you know, that kind of a movie, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
those are always fun.
Yeah, it is really fun. It was a fun movie. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed your show. You've done some really cool pieces. I really liked your Checking the Box features. I think you did a couple shows where you talked about that. Is that right?
Yeah, we also did a piece on the Sanford Center. Our goal with our show is to really talk about what's going on in our community. And when we say our community, we mean that as the Sioux City community. And there's a piece of the community that most of our listeners might not have access to, which is the African-American portion of our community, which is what Ike and I aim to focus on.
Absolutely. So. We just want to give a voice to that and talk about the things that happen in our community, especially when we think about those movies, we think about events going on. And then the things that, you know, like, for instance, you talk about healthcare, and we want to talk about how that affects those in our community and And others.
Yeah.
So we will be hearing you next Wednesday at this time, correct?
Absolutely.
We'll be here.
We can't feel your shoes, though, but, you know, we'll try to make you happy.
We'll do our best. We'll do our best.
I think my shoes will be fine. As long as my shoes aren't here.
I was going to say, your shoes will be on vacation, right?
So. Yes, that's right. Hopefully in water somewhere.
All but right. You can always leave a pair of force, right?
I think so. Well, Shelby Pierce and Ike Rayford, thanks so much for telling us a little bit about next week's program. You're listening to Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3 and KOJI Okoboji 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College. Coming up next, we're going to hear Freakonomics Radio. It's 1 o'clock.